Hey, everybody, and welcome to Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike. My name is Jay.
My name is Mike.
And joining us this week in place of Jack is Mr. AJ Mass.
Hey, how's it going, guys? I think it's only appropriate that this is someone that nobody there has ever heard on this podcast before, because, you know, we had an episode with characters that nobody has ever seen before.
Well, a little bit of behind-the-scenes information for our listeners out there. I actually just did a week-long rain song, and AJ came. I don't know exactly what connotation that means, but I'm happy to have him here. Punyane.
Yes. An interesting episode. I really enjoyed it, but it definitely, leave it to Damon Lindelof and crew just to kind of throw a curveball out there in its last season and following the story of Mr. Kevin Sr. Excited to be here talking about it, and very excited to have the fantastical AJ Mass join the show. First time guesting on any of the Jay and Jack production podcasts. But for those who may never heard you before, AJ, you want to maybe give a quick rundown of why you're amazing?
I am amazing because I used to be Mr. Matt. I mean, really, you don't need any more than that, I don't think. Yeah, I was mascot for the New York Mets for 4 years. I am a writer for ESPN.com. I cover fantasy sports, particularly baseball, being at baseball season now. I've written two books, one called How Fantasy Sports Explains the World, one called Yes, It's Hot in Here, which is a history of mascots. And I podcast a lot about TV shows, Survivor and whatnot with Rob Sestrini Nino and the Rob Has a Podcast crew, and Mike and I have been podcasting a really fun movie podcast called The Hamster Factor for the past year or so. So I'm there on the internet.
Awesome. Well, excited to have you here. Excited to talk about The Leftovers and after last week, which kind of ended on killing this officer. Kevin, and to where we are with this week's episode, what are your guys' kind of initial feelings here on episode 3? Because episode 3 is always kind of like a bit of a pivot shift in terms of like a character story bit line.
Yeah, this is definitely, I think, one of the more polarizing episodes in The Leftovers tenure, and it definitely is one of the more polarizing episodes to come out of The Leftovers. I did not watch International Assassin live like you guys might have, so I have no idea what the crowd reaction was at the time, but very, very divided reactions to this episode after it premiered. There were some that were saying, this is boring, this is dragging on, why are we focusing on this, I hate this. There were some that were saying, I love this, yeah, we really get to get deep down to what was going on with Kevin Sr. I saw a lot of comparisons for you Lost lovers out there to the maligned episode Across the Sea, Ooh. Where Allison Janney served as a mother to Jacob and the Man in Black. And I could sort of understand where they're coming from in terms of the episode placement, in that in the Lost chronology, spoiler alert for Lost, but if you're listening to a Jay and Jack podcast and you haven't seen Lost, what the hell are you doing with your life?
It happens, Sorry. Believe it or not, but still, yeah, it is rare.
but essentially what happens is there's this episode in season 6 where Saeed blows himself up, Jin and Sun end up dying. It's a huge mess with a bunch of our main characters ending up, moving over to the other side, to that great big church somewhere else. And then the next episode takes a break from that action to focus on this entirely different story with a set of different characters. I could kind of see where they're coming from with that argument, but I will say, from what I've been gauging in terms of the reaction online, I enjoyed this episode more than others. Is it my favorite episode of The Leftovers? Not whatsoever. But I think there was a lot to mine out of this. If for anything, Scott Glenn is so mesmerizing as an actor, and I was so happy they gave him a full hour-long venue to display his skills, considering that yeah. Kevin Sr., Papa Garves, has really only been in sporadic parts of the previous 2 seasons. I think there's a lot of connections to be made of the overall theming of faith, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about. Yeah. There's some connections back to the main story, and the last 10 minutes... You might disparage like the first 50, but the last 10 minutes are really top notch. Yeah. So I'm a bigger fan of this episode than I think a lot of the internet populace is.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Like really, the payoff of that was really good. And I think there is some nuggets in there that might be relevant to the greater storyline. AJ, what did you think?
Well, Mike, you know, you and I quite simpatico here because I was going to make all the Alice and Janney and Across the Sea jokes and references, so you beat me to it. I think for me, I had those fears that this was going to turn into that when it started, but it did not. And I think for me, Across the Sea was more of a complete retcon of the plot, trying to shoehorn all the loose threads that they could, and it really felt more of a let's try and explain away the last few things that we really can't explain away and just force them in there. This episode for me felt a lot more like it was filling in the blanks and really giving you a different perspective. And from a thematic standpoint of The Leftovers from the beginning, it's always been about how do you operate under the perspective that you have with the knowledge that you have. And we as the audience, it was really cool because we have more a knowledge than the characters in this episode. And it's one of the few times that I think that we've had that in this series. Usually we're in the dark much more so than the characters. And for once, we are much more in the know. And I think it was refreshing to kind of see the show from that angle. I mean, we'll get into it a little bit more later on. We go scene by scene. But I think that was my overall take on it, that like it was filling in the blanks nicely rather than trying to, you know, just go to the beginning and give you something that we're shoehorning in.
Yeah.
That being said, how do you guys feel about the arguments some of the naysayers have been mentioning about how, you know, we have a final season of this show, a show that is really full of a rich tapestry of fantastic three-dimensional characters, and we have such limited road in front of us. We're only doing 8 episodes. We've already done 2. To decide to take one of these 8 episodes to concentrate on a character that has really been tangential to things for the previous 2 seasons. I mean, I don't want to put ourselves in the place of being in our shoes in the finale 5 weeks from now, but if we're looking back and we're saying we didn't get, you know, our Evie episode, or, you know, we didn't get our John and Erica episode, do you think that this has the potential to possibly be one of those episodes where people will say, you know, I wish we had focused more on the main plot because there's so much there, and instead, why did we have to go tangential to that? Again, that's not something that I personally believe, but I'm sort of playing the straw man here in that I've been seeing people sort of make that argument today.
Well, it definitely is the Matt Nathanson argument of, you know, omitting Kevin Sr.'s storyline here. And you know, Kevin Sr. not being happy with that. But it almost highlights maybe the feeling that maybe some of the viewers have at home, where, you know, he's not even in the book of Kevin. Why are we focusing on this guy? But I would think if they are showing this story, the relevance will show itself, or I would hope the relevance would show itself by the time we come to the finale in 5 weeks' time. But I totally understand that perspective of where people are coming from. But at no point do I think it was a waste of time. But I would see concerns if we're going to miss out on other storylines from other characters that are beloved. That, you know, a whole episode, we couldn't get, you know, a little bit of something else. But, well, time will tell, I think, in that regard. before we jump in to our deep dive recap, want to thank the people that make our show possible, the patrons over at patreon.com/JayandJack. If you'd like to become a patron today, you can do so by clicking the Become a Patron link on jayandjack.com. We have over 150 patrons, and everything that you guys contribute goes to all of our podcasters and making everything happen. So, big thank you to you guys. All right. With that being said, it is time to jump into this recap. Are you guys ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's do this. All right, it's Leftovers recap time. We open up with a new song, a lounge version of a Personal Genius, by Depeche Mode. Thoughts on that here? Like, significance of that song to the overall episode?
I mean, I think the title sort of speaks for itself there. What I want to focus more on is, again, episode one, we're saying, all right, there's got to be some cool new theme song for season three, right?
Yeah.
And so far, we've gotten the same visuals from season two, but it's been overlaid. We had the Perfect Strangers theme song last week. That was an obvious connection.
Yep.
Here we have the Personal Jesus one. I don't know if they just sort of absconded with any sort of idea of a theme song, and if they're just going to play a different song every week over the opening credits. That would be a very odd way of doing things, but this episode is an odd way of doing The Leftovers, so it's sort of par for the course in that regard.
But I think at this point, like, there isn't going to be a song that repeats itself, right? You're three episodes in, and it'd be kind of weird almost if they went to one every single week that was the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. The jokiness of the Perfect Strangers theme from last week, I think, set the right tone for that episode. And I think this song set the right tone for this episode. Plus, the fact that it wasn't the Depeche Mode version, it wasn't the Johnny Cash version, it was this cheesy, literally, yeah, like cheesy... Yeah, Richard Cheese.
It was like a high school jazz combo version of Personal Jesus.
But to me, it also, because it was such a loungy kind of lounge singer kind of thing, it really set the tone for me of kind of like being at the hotel and for, you know, Kevin Jr. having to sing the karaoke. It had a karaoke feel to it. And I think that really highlighted kind of like the leftover spin on things.
And I, you know, Damon famously quit Twitter, but he has been fairly active on Instagram, and he posted a meme before the episode started, and it has you know, the members of Depeche Mode from the video Personal Genius Jesus, and it says, "I know that the lyrics is reach out and touch faith, just as I know that the song is called Personal Cheeses." Yeah. Fun stuff if you follow Damon Lindelof on Instagrams, if you do. Anywho, jumping in with Chief Garvey Sr., what seems to be immediately after the departure, and then there's this kind of gravelly, vintage-sounding, help them, go help them, and he turns around, and then it cuts to Kevin Sr. driving in the Outback, listening to an old tape of young Kevin and him talking about ducks. Kevin is kind of up on some rocks and records an Aboriginal tribe doing ritual song and dance. At night, Kevin Sr. performs his own version. The Outback Fuzz arrives and asks him, "What are you doing?" And Kevin Sr. says, "Preventing the apocalypse. What are you doing?" Setting the tone here for the episode, right?
Or the song line, I guess, if you will. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things where they sort of drop you in the middle of everything and you're supposed to kind of sink or swim, sort of figure out as the rains are coming in exactly what's going on. We're obviously going to find out exactly why Senior is, for lack of a better term, culturally appropriating Aboriginal music. And you could also say that it's Senior's narrative throughout this episode is super interesting as well, in that I think we've seen, obviously, a lot of religious / messiah narratives, known so more prevalent than in the first episode this season when Kevin was literally called a messiah. But this is one example where, you know, Senior's going in being like, "I am the person who will stop the rain. This is on me. This is my cross to bear." But it turns out that as he goes through, he almost screws up everyone around him.
Yeah.
And this is one example here where, like, it's clear that he's like, I mean, the title of the episode is Crazy White Fella Thinking. And it shows that, yes, he very clearly sticks out like a sore thumb here, and that, you know, he's trying to hide there and record their singing, but then he tries to do his own sort of painting and singing along with it, and it just doesn't fit. I want to go back to the ducks for a second. I mean, it's clear that this Niagara trip that's going to be taped is a little off kilter, considering that Senior's going to be taking 8-year-old Kevin Jr. to go see Taxi Driver for some reason later on. But what was going on with the ducks? Did they just have a bunch of duck eggs and they were waiting for them to hatch over the course of this trip?
Well, I thought maybe they were driving by and the ducks went underwater and then he was worried they weren't coming back up or something.
Yeah, that's exactly what I got from it, was that there were these ducks and they were going down under the water and they were staying down for a really, really long time. And you, little Kevin was trying to, you know, he was stressed out because he thought, well, if they go underwater for that time, they'll drown and die and not come back. And suddenly miracle upon miracle, they come back. I mean, it's a little nail on the head there with exactly what we've seen from Kevin Jr. himself. But I think that's kind of the to me, this entire episode in many ways is Lindelof trolling people like us who analyze episodes like this, looking for these answers and picking things apart. And so he's throwing in things like this where, oh, the ducks, that must be important. What does the ducks, what do the ducks mean? And trying to tie it in. I think Kevin Sr., his whole journey for this episode is kind of in that way of how much meaning we're going to put on these little things that really probably don't have any importance in the grand scheme of things, but it's just what we put on them and what we choose to try and put on them.
Nah. To be fair, if Grace Playford was watching those ducks and they went down, she would have just walked off and imagined that the ducks went with God at some point.
That's horrible. Let's move on to Kevin Garvey being taken in and questioned by the police. They reference his map showing the song lines. They want to keep his recording equipment, and but he wants the tape of him and his son, Niagara 81. Later, Garvey Sr. Marks another spot on his songline map, presumably the ritual he just performed. The tape playing Kevin Jr. asking about Hinckley shooting Reagan stops at a post office and asks for the address of Christopher Sunday. Is told to speak to Sharon. She is a liaison to the indigenous community. Kevin Sr. says, with all due respect, I'm a member of the indigenous community. yeah, it's like, ugh, ew. He says that he had mail forwarded to this location. It's for Matt Jameson. And, you know, asks the clerk there, do you know the most popular book of all time? It's the Bible. And he said, this is the goddang sequel. Just Kevin Garvey just does not, you know, from their perspective, has not come across looking very sane.
I also love him going to masquerade as Kevin Jr. in the mail, little postage office shack. Reminds me of, like, there's a scene in The Simpsons where Homer's trying to get a letter that he accidentally sent to Mr. Burns, and he just walks into the post office and is like, hello, my name is Mr. Burns. You have a letter for me, don't you? Like, Kevin, I'm glad that, like, that this guy clearly did not care about any sort of ID check, considering that Kevin Sr. knew exactly what was coming, because, I mean, this is not the last time this episode he's going to try to pass himself off as somebody else, but, the senior is clearly going through a bunch of, here's my buzzword, nefarious means in order to get what he wants at the end.
You know, with the reference to song lines here, that will be interesting how that comes to play a little bit later. So let's move on here to Kevin Sr. He takes out the book and to make markings on the work, I guess, to give feedback. And there's cash in there. And he takes out one of the pages and wraps it up and puts it in the National Geographic in the Cairo page. Again, this could be just a bit of a wink to the broader fans of the show. That National Geographic was kind of one of those props from last season, the season before. Cairo is like one of those things where, mm-hmm. you know, is this place significant, and was digging into it. And so I like the call out there. I like bringing that back into the fold. Reading it, he gets upset. He calls Matt, and Noah picks up, and Mary eventually gets the phone. Garvey Sr. Pretends to be somebody else, but Mary's not really having it, gives the phone to Matt. Things seem to be very tense between Mary and Matt. Kevin Sr. is upset about what Matt is writing. I'm not part of Junior Stories, part of mine. He told me what to do when he was 8 years old. Matt says children don't really feature in Scripture. They argue, and Kevin Sr. tells him to F off. Kevin Sr., not a fan of the Book of Kevin.
Even though he's the lead editor on it, it seems. his edits are also, I don't know, I'm not a professional copy editor, but if you write like F, you write expletives all over the paper that you're trying to work on, the manuscript, it's not so great. But I believe, I don't know if it was on Reddit or somebody else had taken a screenshot of the page that he was editing. It looks like Matt at that point was telling the story about, I think, when him and Kevin buried the corpse of Patty, and they went to go eat in that restaurant where Kevin kind of broke down and he eventually met with Holy Wayne. So I guess the Book of Kevin is super transparent to the point of where they are fessing up to the crimes that he did. But then again, considering how the police that Kevin reported his crime to in the first place didn't care about what had happened to Patty, I guess they're okay.
Yeah, so if it's a GR, it's fine. Kill him. Just blow him up. Whatever you got to do, it's fine. No big deal. No biggie.
Yeah, I mean, what you have to understand, you know, Kevin Sr.'s had a really rough night. He only got a 7 on the dance from Bruno Tonioli. You know, he's really licking his wounds here. And now he finds out that he is not the hero of the greatest sequel of all time. So he's in a bad mood. And I think, it just goes to show that he believes that this story, The Leftovers, is about him. He, in his mind, he is the star of this show, and he's not. But he's going to be the star of this episode. And it's almost like the people who are upset that why are you spending all this time with this character who's not our main character? Like, he himself is upset that he's not the main character. It's like it's a riddle inside an enigma.
I'm on your side.
The audience is Kevin Sr. That's a genius take. I love that. Genius or Jesus, depending on how Jay will pronounce it.
It's definitely... this also kind of... This scene for me kind of... just from my own viewing perspective, that everything here that Kevin Sr. is doing up to this point, the whole songline thing, trying to write the songs, just seems... for not, you know, he doesn't have an understanding of his actual importance in this story, and this scene kind of highlights that for me.
And speaking towards the Matt stuff as well, I mean, this sort of places it in the timeline. We know that Mary's still there, so obviously this takes place before the big reveal of the Book of Kevin, and we already see things are a little strained between the two of them. I do think, I don't want to spoil future episodes too much, but I believe we're going to have another Matt episode as well, as we do every season. So I think we're going to get a little bit more as to what's going on. But yeah, and we get a nice, in true Leftovers fashion, a go F yourself this time to Matt. Though Matt's going to have some retribution later on.
Yes. Yes, he is.
I will say that's one of the really nice things about this episode. Forget about whether you wanted this episode to be, you know, centered on a Kevin Sr. and all that stuff. I just think it was great that we didn't have the need for... Chiron that said, you know, 3 months earlier, 3 weeks later, you just show the kid and we're able to piece it together. They trust that we're able to place in the timeline. And this show, I think, as much as this particular episode, I think, is poking fun at the fans, I think generally this show respects the fans, and I appreciated that.
Yeah, well, and I give Damon credit for a lot of that. Like, all his writing style is never to spoon feed. Like, it's like he's going to put it all out there, and he assumes the audience is smart enough to, you know, either make their own assumptions on what it is and come up with their own interpretations, or be able to just figure out, you know, where they are and why they're there. We then go to Kevin Sr. Meeting Sharon, and he's trying to get the whereabouts of Chris Sunday. There is a warning poster about him. He does a fairly good job schmoozing his way with Sharon, until she sees the posting. And they play a bit of the shame on you game for one, Kevin Sr. Kind of taking something that's not his, and for, you know, all of Australia for what they've done to their indigenous people. Kevin Sr. Steals the info and kind of runs to Chris Sunday. He intros himself to Chris Sunday as Kevin, Totem of the Bush Snake, which will become relevant a little bit later.
This totally reminds me, and sorry to interrupt
you,
of that one Saved by the Bell episode when Zach thought he was part Native American. So he did that whole class presentation that was extremely offensive. That's what Kevin Sr. is doing right now, in my point of view.
Yeah, no,
although I was actually personally disappointed that, you know, given that he's basically being Kaiser Soze here, that he didn't just call himself Kobayashi.
So we kind of then get this big catch-up story to, you know, what Kevin Sr. has been up to as he kind of brings Chris Sunday to why he's here talking to Chris Sunday today. So from, you know, first hearing the voices to his institutionalization, and then, you know, finally listening to the voices and going to Australia. They didn't really give anything beyond that. So, you know, this hippie tells him, you know, he needs to talk to God and takes God's tongue. And he wakes up 2 weeks later in Perth, and he doesn't know how he got there. Now, can we assume within that where he doesn't remember, that's when he talked to Kevin in the International Assassin episode?
You have to assume so, and that's the larger implications because, again, I don't know if this was brought up in this podcast, but I know that there are some corners of the Leftovers community that after International Assassin, even when they went back to the hotel in the season two finale, some people still thought, oh, this is all in Kevin's mind. This is, you know, some sort of larger allegory for the afterlife, not a literal interpretation. But I think the fact that we see now the other side of the conversation as to how Kevin Sr. got to this burned up mattress in Perth decked out in his best Aboriginal war paint shows that that was indeed a real conversation that happened, albeit it seemed to happen between planes.
Yeah,
I disagree.
Oh, you disagree? Ooh, okay. It's the opposite.
I completely disagree. Because, again, to me, you know, we're aware of the fact that Kevin had this experience, Kevin Jr., in the hotel and everything like that. But looking at on at face value, if we're not going to really buy that Tony the Chicken is telling Kevin Sr. where to go and what to do, then we're just doing a really, really good job of cherry picking the things that we're going to say, ah, well, that proves that he actually was there, when he could just have been high on this God's tongue and you know, how do we know that he didn't tell Kevin Jr. at some point, yeah, I was in this hotel and I dreamed I saw you. And that's what Kevin dreamed about when, you know, when he had his experience. I mean, we have no idea. And if we're not going to accept Tony the Chicken as having magical powers, which I'm not willing to do, then I'm not willing to necessarily say that anything that in this story is to be taken at face value. And yet we're doing it because it's a TV show. And that's what Kevin Sr.'s doing. And we're Kevin Sr. And if he's nuts, we're nuts.
No, and that, but that's the complete point, is that I think this, again, goes back to the idea of faith. You know, in this after look on the episode that they did on HBO, Damon kind of goes into this little talking head about the fact that, you know, after big moments of crises in the planet's history, a lot of religion sprung up that I think on paper a lot of people would say are completely questionable, but people want to ascribe meaning to certain things in order to give themselves some sort of satisfaction that lets them sleep at night. And so I do think it's purposeful. I agree that we're sort of putting ourselves in the mind of Kevin Sr. and really everyone else in the way that we can sort of derive symbology and meaning from things that don't necessarily mean anything. The season two theme was let the mystery be for a reason, but I think it's totally legitimate for us to make claims like this because that's just what the characters are doing. This sort of, again, represents the larger microcosm of humanity that is represented through the Leftovers itself.
And yet we're believing that some of these characters are wrong. So, I don't think it tells us one way or the other, and I think that's the point. You know, when it comes down to it. And I just love the fact that the acting job by the actor who played Chris Sunday to be in this scene, I mean, you know, all props to the scene itself and Scott Glenn, who was amazeballs. But it works because Chris Sunday's just his nods and tilts of the head and him taking it in and just reading his eyes and his expressions when he's just listening to a story just like us. And you have to wonder, what is he thinking this whole time when he doesn't know anything that we know? I just love this from just on a meta level. This scene and this entire episode is just A-plus stellar.
Well, and but that's the beauty of like a Lindelof show, like, and it goes, you know, even Lost, it's the whole man of science versus man of faith, and like how do you attribute certain things, and you know the eternal struggle between Locke and Jack, and how that all eventually, like, it's I think the Leftovers is almost like that debate in pure, you know, uncut form is what this show is, and what Damon has been exploring in this show. And I think you can have both. I think you can say, you know, Tony the Chicken, that was, you know, that doesn't matter. But he actually did connect with his son through with whatever plane. And I think you can justify it because it's Kevin Jr.'s story, not Kevin Sr.'s, and that's where there was a moment there that he doesn't even remember, that where he did kind of cross into this other plane of existence because he was so high. But again, that's just an interpretation of it, which is what makes the Lindelof shows and the things that he creates so great, because you can have like 10,000 different interpretations about one moment in the show, which makes for fun podcasting.
Yeah, and I think we also need to take this same grain of salt that we're giving to people like Grace, who are saying that, oh, you know, I thought if I did this and that, I'd be able to talk to my children through God, compare it to Nora last week, who's about to apparently fly to Melbourne to undergo this really insane science study to be able to try to talk to her children. I think, again, it just shows the length that certain people will go in order to maybe even, you know, close the loop in a way, you know, say something that you really wanted to say, but you never did because you never thought this type of thing would happen. And now we get to see sort of a different side through the Kevins here. But I, you know, I'm assuming that Kevin Jr. and Kevin Sr. are going to cross paths at some point later on this season. I think the earlier conversation with Matt alluding to the Abraham Isaac story was not Lindelof poking fun at us. I do think that's going to come into play at some point, considering that they made notice of the fact that Isaac or Abraham, the son, was well into his 30s when he got sacrificed. So, you know, I think the parent-child theming is something that's been prevalent throughout the entire time in The Leftovers, and I think we've seen three very clear cases as to the lengths that some parents will go to talk to their children, whether that be through fraudulent means or what they feel are realistic.
Yeah, good call out. Really good call out. You know, after waking up in Perth, the TV is on, he gets intro to Tony the Chicken. And he goes there, he's looking for purpose, and Tony pecked on the tape of him and his son. He kind of tells the story of the tapes where they went on this trip after his wife died of cancer, and this tape recorder is, this, you know, one of the last things that he got or she got him before she passed, and so he wanted to be a news reporter, so he just kept, you know, running this tape. So the tape plays a moment between Junior and him where it's raining, and he sings "Itsy Bitsy Spider" to stop the rain. Now he is learning the songs from, you know, the indigenous people, and Chris Sunday's song is the last one he has to learn to complete his task. And Chris asked him to start with stopping the flooding in his house, aka fixing the swamp cooler. So with Tony the Chicken pecking at the tape here, me after this one was like, oh, I'm sorry, Kevin Sr., you're just wrong. Does anybody here think that he's actually right in this quest?
I don't necessarily think that he's right. I mean, look, he's listening to a chicken, who, you know. But
what if the chicken's right?
But I think in many ways this is, and we're going to see this with the next scene too, that it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy at this point. He believes that there is something, some purpose out there, and it didn't really matter what Tony the Chicken did, or, you know, if he had turn on the TV at a different moment, it was something else, he would have found something that steered him in a direction. It may not have come here, but something, he would have figured out a way to get it to the next place, and he would have put meaning on that. He is imbuing the chicken with meaning. He is imbuing this with meaning. So I think in that sense, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy here, and it didn't matter what the sign was. He would end up where he wanted to end up.
But the thought of this flood that's coming, like, is that because it in the previous for the season, it seemed like that was a thing that they were kind of referencing. Is he right in that, or is it really he's just kind of, you know, picking things out of the air essentially?
I mean, this sort of reminds me of prior conversations that have happened in The Leftovers where things will take a super serious tone and someone's very concerned and energetic about the fact that we need to do this, and then they'll just drop something that's completely insane and sort of derails the conversation. This happened in the first episode this season when Dean came back and he's like, hey, I think there's, you know, there's really a problem in our country, dog people. Or, you know, I keep referring to that conversation last season in Lens when someone calls Nora and is like, you know, I think you are cursed, you are a danger because the demon Azrael has decided to put his spirit within you and you will curse all those around you, which might be looking more and more legitimate as the time passes. But I think that this is another key example where, again, it's just what we talked about, where you're sort of in on a character just because maybe you get to know them or you've been following them for a while, so that when something, a belief system comes out of left field like it does with the chicken and the I have to sing a song to stop the world from flooding, you sort of take pause and say, that's a little cuckoo bananas. But you also have to kind of then turn it back on yourself and say, wait, why am I judging a character that I was all in on beforehand? Just because, you know, and not to say I'm not necessarily comparing Kevin Sr. to someone like Dean, who I don't think any of us were all in on. But I mean, I was definitely buying what Scott Glenn was putting down the past two seasons. He seemed reasonably confident in himself, saying, you know, once I listened to the voices, I was good to go. And now to hear that he basically is led to the path he currently is because he listened to a piece of fowl, that's pretty foul to me. Pun unintended there. So I couldn't help but judge him. But at the same time, personally speaking, it made me have my own sort of crisis of faith in that, like, why am I judging this? As a TV viewer, why am I necessarily judging him? Because as you said, AJ, it was really just the verification that he needed. He was essentially searching for someone to tell him, yeah, you're going in the right direction. You're doing the right thing. And he got it in the form of this chicken. So no matter what the means may be, if the ends are what you need to get to at the end of the day, I guess they justify them.
Yeah, I think it comes down to we're dealing with a world where there was a pretty out of the ordinary event that did take place. I mean, can you imagine a pre-departure, like the month leading up to departure, if there was a guy who every day said, you know, tomorrow 2% of the population is going to disappear, tomorrow's 2%, and he's on the same street corner saying it every single day, and these people in the town are listening to him every day and they think he's nuts, and you happen to walk by the day before the departure and he says it and it actually happens the next day, you're going to think this guy is magic and is like has some sort of insight. And I think, you know, if Christopher Sunday is hearing this and it jives with what he believes and what he knows and his experience, then he might take, him at face value. Whereas to the normal person in our world, we wouldn't. But in this world, maybe you would.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. So while on the roof trying to fix the swamp cooler, Sharon comes into town. And Garvey, you know, Francis, don't believe anything she says. And as he's trying to, prevent, being taken away, he falls off the roof, injuring Chris and himself. In the ambulance, Garvey Sr. Tries to get the song from him, or at least say, hey, I need to be with this guy. I can't leave him because I think he knows his chances are running thin here. The medic wants him to quit interfering. Garvey gets ornery and says he's a Yamjanarian. Respect your effing elders. To which he gets kicked out of the ambulance. I would think rightfully so from the medic's perspective. He wanders in the outback listening to the Niagara 81 tape. A black Beetle, a Volkswagen Beetle, pulls up. A man comes out in a suit. He douses the car and self in gas. Garvey Sr. tries to stop him. Man says, would you kill a baby if it could cure cancer? Sr. says no. Man says, that's exactly what I said. He lights himself up, and the bug blows up. So, weird kind of scene. Will this scene have a lot more relevance outside of this episode? Or is it just like a weird one?
I think it will. Only because of what Mike said earlier. I think we are probably going to look back at this and see a setup where Kevin Sr. is going to be put in a situation where he can indeed save the world, but he's going to have to kill his own son to do it. Would you kill a baby if it could cure cancer? Would you kill your own son if it meant you could save the world? Mm-hmm. And here he says he wouldn't do it. I think, will he do it when it comes down to it? Will he actually do it? I think we're going to get to that moment. And I don't know what the ramifications are going to be if he can. I think we all want to see him go, Kevin get killed again and go back to the hotel. But, will that only work in Miracle? I don't know. But I don't know if Senior will be able to go through with it. And if so, then he's really not the hero of the Book of Kevin that he thinks he is. And maybe that'll be the moment when he realizes it.
Hopefully I'm not usurping Jack's crackpot theory here. But what if Mr. Self-Immolation was an applicant to that study that we were just talking about, the one that Mark Lynn Baker and Nora into. And maybe they have to answer a questionnaire, much like those that, you know, have departed and were submitting to their own questionnaire. And that's, it's not necessarily about the people that departed. It's just one of the questions in the personality test. And he happened to fail it. As a result, he wasn't able to get the closure and connect with the person that he wanted to. So he decided to take himself out right there, right then, in the middle of the outback.
That's a damn good hot take right there.
I wasn't sure coming in if I would have a hot take, but one just broke into my mind like a flame.
Well, and here's where it could also have just been. I mean, I just said that I think it will come back and it'll have meaning. If it doesn't come back and the scene just exists as an oddball when all is said and done, I think this could again be just a case of grade A trolling by Lindelof, because, you know, I could see that maybe he was at a job interview. And he didn't get the job, you know, they didn't let him in. They passed him over, and he's going back over the job interview in his mind and trying to figure out, well, why did they say no? They wouldn't tell me why they said no. Why did they say no? And in the end, he just blows himself up because he can't deal with it. And in a way, that's Lindelof telling the fans, look, if I don't answer your questions for the one question that you want answered in this series, you know, don't light yourself on fire, people. It's not that big a deal. Just go on with your life. I could definitely see it as kind of a commentary on all the lost questions that weren't answered and thus forth. I mean, it certainly could play that way.
Yeah, it could. And I think Damon at least has said, you know, don't go into this expecting answers for certain things. You know, so hopefully the viewers at home aren't expecting some grant. But for the most part, I feel like, aside from the departure, it really hasn't been about trying to solve these mysteries the way that Lost was. And say maybe the way Westworld is very much like this mystery unfolding. And it's more about the kind of this character journey.
Two things about this past scene. First, I know you said, Jay, that they had every sort of reason to throw him out of the ambulance. I know that on the Jay and Jack Facebook page, people might have been of a different mind, though. I know some people said that it was heartless of the ambulance driver to kick a man out with a broken foot in the middle of the outback. But I guess, you know, when you're... I'm assuming he was needling the unconscious corpse of Christopher Sunday for quite some time. So I don't know if it's warranted. I don't know if it's justified, but that might be a reason. But I think it's so interesting to sort of track the trajectories of Senior versus the person he was accosting on the phone before, Matt, in that there does seem to be a little bit of Job-like tendencies between the two. Senior's got a little bit of Jameson on him, in that it seems like in this episode, I mean, he's going to yell at God in this next scene saying, like, hey, you try to do everything to stop me, it's not going to stop me. And it does seem like a lot of unfortunate circumstances seem to befall him. But where it sort of contrasts, again, is that I do feel like while Matt might have his dark moments, like, again, beating the snot out of that one guy who tried to carjack him in his season one episode, for the most part, he's a good person that just happens to get perennially crapped upon by the man upstairs. But what Senior's trying to do is he's really trying to, again, shoehorn himself into a narrative to be what he thinks is the good Samaritan, when really he's just kind of acting like a big asshole.
Yeah.
And so that's why he's getting retribution for it. But he might be twisting it in his own way, like, oh, I'm being tested now.
Yeah.
I am truly the prophet, but this is a way for the powers that be to test me, just like you have tested Nora Durst and Matt Jameson before me.
Yep. Agreed.
Indeed. And on top of that, like, you know, let's face it, if the way to save the world is to have this song sung from beginning to end, I don't think there's any rule book here that it has to be one person. And he's insinuating himself here into being the hero, being the person, literally by being the one person who's going to memorize all these songs. And in the process, he puts himself in a situation where he falls off a roof and kills the one person who has the last part of the song.
Yeah.
And if he had just minded his own business, perhaps they could have all gotten together and sung the stupid song.
Yep.
So, yeah. You know, it's like, don't insinuate yourself where you don't belong, because you're just going to make a mess of things.
The concept of the song reminded me a lot of the Netflix series, The OA. And I won't spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but there's very much a similar concept of you need to get certain parts, like a video game, get certain parts of this certain song in order to stop an event from happening.
Well, there you go. So after the car blows up, Garvey Sr. looks through the car for water. There seems to be vodka, which doesn't explode for some reason, in the bottle. He yells at the sky, saying, "I know what you're trying to do, but you can't stop me, a-hole." And the sky opens up to kind of torrential downpour. Garvey gets a drink of water, then realizes his tape player is getting soaked. The next day, he tries to test it out, but the tape deck is fried. Garvey Sr. continues the journey through the outback, comes across his totem, a.k.a. bush snake. He tries to kill it for food, but it's not dead yet. Always double tap. It bites him. He continues on until he gets to a cross. He lays down at it, takes out the passage from the book that he wrapped the cash in, and he passes out. As he's passing out, a person and a horse comes, and he kind of says out help. And then he kind of goes unconscious. So even though Garvey Sr. to me is kind of being an a-hole through most of this episode, I did also feel really bad when the tape deck was fried because of just his attachment to what it was.
Though he again could attest to it, saying like, "Oh yes, this is another test. You have all my worldly possessions taken away from me, so all I have left is my faith. I want to know from you, Jay, as someone who has been warding off snakes in the past week, do you have a better strategy than what Kevin Sr. tried to do of just whack him with a crutch?"
Me personally, I don't mind snakes. So we have a black snake here, and he's a good snake. He's warding off the evil ones. But growing up in Southern California, we have a lot of snakes, a lot of rattlesnakes, and you need to do a much better job making sure that thing is dead before you're just going to go up there and try to eat it. I question his form in the snake killing there.
Yeah, and before the snake, I just noticed that for me, if I were Kevin Sr. and I truly believed everything that I was saying, why didn't I just start singing Itsy Bitsy Spider? Because then the brain would stop.
Ooh.
You know, and he didn't. And part of it is because I think he knows subconsciously that he doesn't really have that kind of power, and the rain just started, and it's not going to stop immediately. And by failing there, it would poke holes in his story. So you just don't sing so that you don't have any contradiction in your head, and you're able to, go on and then continue in your delusion.
That good call out there. Good call.
Do you think there was any chance that after being bitten by a snake, Kevin Sr. would have the same trajectory as the woman from the prologue in season 2? Who also got bitten by a snake and she crawled her way to the end of the what ended up being the Jordan Lake and just ended up sort of dying there. Do you think there's a chance that Senior could have possibly gone the same route as she did?
Possibly. I mean, good callback. Good callback for sure. I mean, and it's just there. It's another good allusion to just biblical texts and snakes and just historically what they've kind of represented. And the fact that that's his totem as well, I think is just a good, story analog there to put in. Also, did anybody feel like when the tape deck was broken, I was like, really, no digital backup? No digital backup here of the tape? If it's your only one, I'd want to make sure that,
Well, Kevin Sr. strikes me as the type of person whose VCR is still blinking 12, and he still has a VCR. So technology, not exactly his forte, probably.
Yeah, maybe not. Yeah. Maybe not. So he wakes up in a child's room with a dog staring at him. He is IV'd and cathed up, and he takes both out.
La 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 la.
Oh.
La la la.
The home is empty, and he calls Matt early in the morning in Jordan time. And Kevin wants to know what day it is, and he finds out it's only 8 days before the 7th anniversary. Matt needs him to send a copy of the book back, which kind of puts us in not only the 8 days out, but also the timeline that he's already given Kevin the book, and he's worried he's not going to get it back. Garvey Sr. says he threw it away. You need to get past your dumb book. He wants help getting to Sunday. Matt tells him to go F himself. He goes outside and sees people working on an ark, and asks if they know Sunday. A man tells him, "You're the one that fell on him. He's dead."
Okay. So you might wonder at the end of this episode, where did these people come from? Who are these people? And why did Grace say later on that I live here alone? Let's remember when Grace describes her children and when Kevin Sr. is looking through the photo album. Now, again, this is a question as to whether this is real or this is imaginary, whether he's actually talking across the plains. but it could be possible that these are the spirits of the dead children now grown up working on this arc. Because, again, knowing what we know, they would have no idea that the rains were coming. You know, it's not like Kevin Sr. really imparted his knowledge onto anyone except for Sunday, we're assuming. So I'm totally could see this as some sort of snake venom, maybe a little bit of God's tongue left in his system, sort of fever dream where he talks to these spirits of these dead children who, according to him, are working in his spirit to build this arc for when the rains come.
I didn't get that at all, but great call out. That's a good, another hot take.
And it's certainly all of everything that we said, you know, I know even if I'm disagreeing with you, Mike, at certain points, it's all possible until they tell us what their story is and everything. You know, I think it probably is a snake venom delusion. That's kind of what I was thinking it was. And everything, because everything in the delusion kind of points him to reinforce his belief that the flood is indeed coming and he's right. And B, keeps him from having to pursue Sunday because he wasn't going to get the help from Matt anymore. So this was a way of him to no longer need to search for that by saying, oh, well, he's dead, so I don't have to worry about that anymore. I think it's very internally, the logic is very consistent there for him to keep his point of view and not to have his delusion shattered. And I mean, I'm operating under the assumption that it's a delusion. And even if there is a flood that happens, he could still be delusional.
Yeah.
and so that's kind of where my head is at with this.
No, just for me, as I watch it, I just watched it like it was just a straight scene. Like there's people there working on this thing. And so, yeah, that's, I did not feel that at all, but now seeing it, I was like, oh, of course that's what it is. Of course it's a snake venom dream, and of course it's the kids, you know, grown up in their spirits or whatever. And it's not, but either way, really interesting way for that scene to play out. Whether it validates him or it's all just, you know, whatever his mind is kind of, his ego saving himself from.
Yeah, I like how Senior can now sort of say, like, oh, no, this is true. I'm backed up by my followers. All these dead children, they're all behind me. These are all the Seniorites. They're the ones, all the deceased are working for me. Why aren't you, Junior?
And the other thing that I think is really great about this is that we're all, and myself included, are so willing to accept everything that Kevin Jr. goes through at face value. Even that first season when we weren't sure whether he was delusional or not, we still kind of, because he was our point of view character and we were seeing the world through his eyes, you know, for the most part, except on those episodes, obviously, where we went to someone else's point of view. But generally speaking, anything that Kevin Jr. goes through, I accept as happening because he's our point of view character. Whereas here, Kevin Sr. is not our point of view character, so I'm not as willing as a viewer to accept anything he's seeing as at face value. And it's kind of interesting there that, you know, by him not being the hero of the story, that's coloring the way whether I believe him or not. Mm-hmm. And I just love that he could be right and every other character could be wrong, but I'm not willing to accept it simply because he's not the main character. And I think that's hilariously brilliant from the writing staff.
I know that we talk a lot about the theming of faith in general with The Leftovers, but I feel like an equally prevalent theme is this idea of communication, of storytelling in a way that, you know, to coin a term that I know a certain Survivor contestant likes to use, everyone's the hero of their own narrative in that regard. So even going back to somebody like John Murphy in season 2, who did some pretty damn heinous things. It was all for his belief, him saying, I'm the hero of this town because we want to maintain the sanctity and pristine aspects of this town that did not lose anyone during the departure. And so one fun thing, as you said, AJ, that I love about this show is that they really play with these people saying, like, it makes sense why they do these things that look to us ridiculous, because in their heads they believe that this is their story and they're doing everything to show what is right for them in the end. And yeah, I think now we sort of get a sense to say, okay, we're done with our unreliable narrator Prime. Let's go to our second unreliable narrator, who clearly, you know, seemed to have a pretty level head, even though he was hearing voices. But now he's doing absolutely ridiculous things, including maybe communicating with dead children.
Yeah, and you know, are we seeing the splits in factions in these religions? You have the seniorites with the and the, on one side, and the juniors on the other other side. Like, is this what we're seeing right now? A splintering of the two Kevins?
Oh, this is going to be the Sunnis and Shias of the next generation. Absolutely, it could well turn into that. Like, you know, they both base their beliefs on the Book of Kevin. It's just that, you know, but the unwritten chapter is where I did this, and you didn't write that, but we're going to add that to our book. So absolutely.
And it brings more context to the "you just got the wrong Kevin" to the end of the episode. Well, let's close out this episode with the last scenes here. Garvey Sr. takes the dog's arthritis meds and peruses a scrapbook of a family and their adopted children, passes out, and we come to the scene from last week's ep, the killing of Officer Kevin. Garvey, we kind of go to the scene where Garvey comes out like, "Hey, what's going on?" And he gets tranked, and he wakes to the woman we saw last week, Grace. She tells a story of what happened to her around her departure, the horrible way she lost her children, how she found Garvey Sr., and he had this passage of what read like scripture, and she thinks it's fate that the chief of police, Kevin, is just 20 kilometers from here, and once I'd proven my faith, he would let me talk to my children one last time. But she said, "You know, she says, you're not an angel, there is no message, and God doesn't care about me, it's all just a story I told myself." And she asks Garvey Sr., "I've got to be crazy, haven't I?" And then Garvey Sr. replies, "I don't think you're crazy at all. You just got the wrong Kevin," and closes out the episode.
I mean, this monologue is, again, say what you want to about the first part of this episode, the majority of it, but this monologue is just so, so good and so well delivered by Lindsay Duncan, who... AJ, I don't know if you recalled Lindsay Duncan, a show that you and I both love, Black Mirror. I believe Lindsay Duncan appeared in the very first episode, so there's another connection there with another themey, heady show.
I did not make the connection at all, but I mean, I'm not surprised that she's done other good stuff, because someone like this may not be, you know, a lot of actors, you know, don't necessarily break on the American shores, but certainly coming from other countries, you can sometimes catch these gems of performances. This monologue, I mean, if this episode had just been the monologue that Senior gives to Sunday and this monologue, that would have been enough for me. Acting tour de force from both of them.
Yeah, agreed. And again, it brings up that theme again of, you know, what is faith and what is it for these different people that have gone through these different things, and you know what actually happened to her kids, such a horrible, horrible thing, even beyond just the departure, you know, you can see why she would do that. You know, you'd see why, you know, this one piece of paper with this, you know, scripture written by somebody in Texas, and the meaning she puts upon it, and what she thinks going to happen with it. And it's just this, it's Leftovers at its best is this really good mirror to, you know, the human condition. And this scene was just a perfect microcosm of what this show does really, really well.
Absolutely, Jay. Absolutely. And just the fact that it's everything that she says in that story makes sense from her point of view. Absolutely. Yep. That from her point of view and her seeing all the Bibles lined up, that's her way of you know, saying, they all went in the departure. That's what happened to them. Whereas someone who perhaps didn't have the same sort of belief that she did would say, if they had all departed, those Bibles would have hit the floor and not been in a straight line. Clearly, someone physically had to put them in that straight line. The children are someone still here. And that would have probably been my point of view if I had, you know, encountered this scene as someone who didn't know these people, like, you know, a policeman coming in. But of course, she's not calling the police. You know, she's like, this is what happened. This must be what happened.
And it's interesting countering this with the smidge that we got of John Murphy in the first episode, where he says, "Evie's not dead. I know. She escaped us once. She eluded us once. She did it again. I'm going to find her." Almost the opposite opinion of what Grace did, who was essentially her, I wouldn't say she threw in the towel, but she sort of, again, as you said, AJ, supplemented her own sort of rationale in her head of, "Oh, this is obviously where they went. now I have this path that I need to go down. Whereas John Murphy seems to be going down almost the opposite path of, I know my daughter's still out there, even though she might not be, according to Erica last week. It's interesting to see, again, this parent-child theming about what parents might do in order to reach their kids, whether that means that I know they're alive, even though they might not be, or I don't think they are alive, so let me try to do other things to communicate them in some other way.
Yep. Thoughts on Kevin Sr. saying you've got the wrong Kevin. Is this him turning, pivoting to realizing that Kevin Jr. is the star of the story, or is he continuing down his kind of own delusions of grandeur?
I think it's absolutely the latter. Like AJ said, I think we're sort of setting up for Kevin Sr. to say, like, okay, Australia is my territory, which again should make things interesting if and when Jr. comes down to Australia, if he runs into him, and now Sr. can similarly say, you're in my story, you're not supposed to be in my story. I think that Sr. did suffer a crisis of faith throughout this episode, including when, you know, he lost Sunday. It seemed to him like all hope was lost at that moment, that the last piece of the song that could have saved the world from his point of view had now died out with a squish, quite literally. But now he's found someone who he can sort of recruit now and has really sort of emboldened him to continue down that path. So again, I can understand where people might have gripes with this episode from a pacing perspective in comparison to the rest of the season, but I feel like we found out so many fascinating things about Kevin Sr. that I really hope it sets up some really interesting narrative payoffs down the line.
Yeah,
I think it's a perfect setup. I agree with you, Mike. This is a perfect setup. It wasn't an episode that took us so far tangentially. I mean, it really just brought us right back to where now when Junior and Nora arrive in Australia, we know exactly where we are in the story. It fills in last week's cliffhanger when we thought, oh my goodness, like where are they? Are they in the future? Like, I think it, oh no, they're, you know, we still don't know where Nora is, you know, from the first episode. But in terms of the Book of Kevin, perhaps spawning off this faith and everything, no, this is present day. It is not in the future. We got an answer to a question one episode later. So I think it definitely was a definite setup. And it wasn't so far removed that we have to worry about they wasted an episode. Yeah, maybe if this was episode 7 of the season with one to go and they had done a divergence, perhaps we could have, I might have felt a little different. But this was great. I thought this informed the story. It gave us as the audience a look at from a different angle that none of the other characters are going to have. And I think that gives us more information than the characters. And that's always a good thing.
I agree. All right, well, that is what we thought about this episode. Now it's time to go into what you guys thought with listener feedback. We got a couple calls here and one from none other than Action Jackson himself. We'll see if his crackpot theory got Ethan'd by any of us here today. So let's go into those now.
Listener feedback.
Hey, this is Jack, longtime podcaster, first time calling with my thoughts about the latest episode of The Leftovers. I know a lot of people might think it was a slow episode, maybe a little boring, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the performance of Scott Glenn and Lindsay Duncan. I thought they were both outstanding. When Grace was telling that story at the end, who didn't get choked up, a little bit sad. Scott Glenn's performance as Kevin Garvey Sr. was, I just thought, amazing. I was glued to the screen the whole time. And in fact, when he falls off the roof and kills Chris Sunday, who didn't laugh? I thought it was funny. The guy setting himself on fire, I thought was interesting. And, of course, his little tapes he had with his young son, Kevin Jr., I thought were touching. I thought it was a good scene. My crackpot theory is going to be that Matt is going to be the Judas to Kevin Jr. I think he's going to turn on Kevin Jr. I think we'll find that out well before the season's over. That is my crackpot theory. I'm sticking to it. And I also like to point out that to my critics who are upset with me, yes, I actually did phone it in this week. So there you go. Have a good show, guys. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, Jay, Jack, and Mike. It's Michael here calling from Los Angeles. Just calling about this most recent Leftovers episode. I really think that Damon missed the mark on this one. I thought overall it was just boring, the storyline was meandering, and it ultimately had no payoff. The name of the episode is Crazy White Fella Thinking, And I feel like you could apply that to Damon Lindelof, a crazy white fella thinking he made another masterpiece episode, but really it was just a dud. I feel like he could have had so much more potential. We had all these scenes of him walking in the desert, you know, encountering a snake, encountering a guy about to light himself on fire. You know, it just kind of slowed down and got very uninteresting at parts. I think the most fascinating element was the very end, that final conversation with Grace. But I think even that, as compelling as that was, it didn't really reveal something groundbreaking. It's kind of like, okay, yeah, Kevin is the one that they're looking for. I think it'll go down as an episode that you have to show someone and apologize afterwards. Like, oh, sorry you had to watch that one. It's part of it. Not his best work. I expect more, I think, is what I'm saying. Especially in such a shortened season. I agree with you guys in that I thought all these episodes were going to knock it out of the park. And I don't think it's that my expectations are too high. I think he can do better. I know that, I hope the rest of the season is better than this one. And I hope some of what we saw in this episode has a payoff down the line. Cause I think if it didn't, it was kind of just there for the sake of being there. Anyways, hope you have a good show.
All right. Thank you for those calls. First, Jack, so he wasn't Ethan. He had an original crackpot theory.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I'm going to, you know, buy into it because I was the one that suggested in the first episode of this season that I thought Matt was going to have his own little dark side, and I think it's clear that he is going to, almost like we talked about with Kevin Senior this episode, sort of do whatever it takes for him to work towards the solution that he wants to in the end through the book of Kevin. And so I don't know if it means that Matt will betray Junior, but that could be a way he breaks bad. So I could see some legitimacy in Jack's theory there.
Also, kudos to him for doing like a lot of research for that call. Like, he came in, he had like the names and the actors. Like, he phoned it in, but he actually did probably some of his best podcasting work he's done in years. So, thanks, Jack. for our next caller, Michael.
Neglected to mention this in the recap as well, but I think that Jack did a nice job of pointing it out. Scott Glenn also did a really funny job here as well. It really was a tour de force performance across the entire emotional spectrum. But again, I feel like Leftover Season 3 is doing a lot of low-key dark humor, and like Scott Glenn's just continued exasperated reactions to everything around him was really, really fantastic. So I agree with him there as well.
Yes. All right, this next call here from Michael from Los Angeles, not happy with this episode. I feel like it's a good call because it's a lot of maybe some of the thoughts or sentiments of this episode, which I think we've covered a bit. But anything we've missed in terms of or addressing some of Michael's frustrations that he had in this call?
I think for me, it really comes down to the difference between binging a show and waiting a week between episodes. And when you've waited a week for an episode, especially, you know, with such a small order of episodes and each one you wait for, you can sometimes, if you get an episode like this, it does feel like, wow, I have to wait another week for the answers to the questions, or oh gosh, I hope this pays off. If you were able to just go from last week's episode to this week's episode to next week's episode, bang, 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 and get through the season, I don't think that they land the same way. And I think you get to that next episode and maybe see a little bit more of how it links last week's to next week's a lot faster. And I just think your opinion changes based on that. And his opinion is perfectly valid. I don't agree with it, but I think until you see the entirety of the series, I don't think we can know exactly whether or not this was a necessary detour or what value it brings to it. I mean, I enjoyed it as a standalone piece, and I enjoyed it in the course of the series thus far. But sure, if the next few episodes never come back to this and never really reference it, then I could totally understand the outrage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with AJ. I think totally in the moment, I mean, that's what hot takes are meant for, to sort of build your frothing rage or your infectious smiles as a result of this episode, I think you totally have a right to that. But I will sort of caution people to, no matter what your opinion is, tamper them as much as you can, as AJ said, until we find out if this pays off or not. If it turns out not to, and it's a rare swing and a miss on behalf of the Leftovers creators, so be it. But I have my own personal faith in Damon and Tom at this point that they will have it pay off in some way, in some shape, where you can look back and say, this makes sense in the grand narrative of things.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the way people maybe apologize, or at least on this podcast, we've talked about season one being, it's tough to get through season one, but it's worth it because season two is amazing. I don't have the same feelings on this episode, you know, that this is, we're going to be apologizing for this episode when we talk about it later, because it does belong. It does not feel out of place to the story, and honestly, it does catch up this storyline that we know has been happening. We've gotten little glimpses into it, you know, this whole Kevin Garvey Sr. going to Australia and then him showing up in the International Assassin episode. So it's a story that matters, and it feels out of place just because we haven't really spent any time focusing on it, but it belongs there.
Yeah, it's not like he knocked on the door of that cabin and Bai Ling opened it up and gave him a tattoo.
Yeah.
Okay. Big difference.
I mean, Scott Glenn really is a stranger in a strange land in Australia, though, so the theme fits.
Oh man. But yeah. But no, Mike, I really appreciate for the call, calling in with those thoughts. I think, you know, it's good to get everybody's perspective on that. But I think let's hold judgment. I think the panel of podcasters here has said just to hold judgment until we've got the whole thing, and then we'll see. All right. Well, that is what we got for our listener feedback. There is no Crackpot Theory of the Week. Jack called it in. Mike, any hot takes that you'd want to put in beyond the great hot takes you had throughout the episode? Any grand hot takes?
I might as well quit while I'm ahead at okay. this point. You know, I think this episode is one large hot take. And like I just mentioned, I think it's yet to be determined as to the significance that this episode is going to play. But I will again repeat what I said at the very top of this podcast, taking it cyclical, almost like Kevin Sr.'s opinion about himself this entire episode. I think that this is one of the most highly contested episodes in the entire history of The Leftovers, and it is yet to be seen as to where on the divide it's going to fall, but I personally am optimistic. You know, it seems like, not to spoil too much about next week, but it seems like we are finally getting Junior and Nora to Australia at the hopes that the father and son are going to meet up once again this season, and we might see that narrative play out a little bit more. But that being said, you know, I can understand where people might find it, as Michael said, boring, meandering, no payoff, etc. But if you watch it for one thing, watch it for Scott Glenn's performance, and number two would be Lindsay Duncan's monologue, because those two were just absolutely fantastic, and it makes me always remember that the caliber of performance alone and The Leftovers is second to none on television.
Agreed. All right. Well, that's where we'll wrap up this episode of Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike. If you'd like to give us a call, you can do so at 385-309-0311. Call anytime. Also, you can send an email to leftoversjj@gmail.com. It's leftoversjj@gmail.com. I want to send a special thanks to Tack from Tokyo, Eckhart Richter, and Molly the Millennial, and all of our patrons that contribute to our podcasting network every single month. If you'd like to become a patron, you can do so today by clicking on the Become a Patron link on jnjack.com. We have a full list of all of our patrons there that we thank. This week, I believe we're doing the Patron's Choice. Is a bit of a tease, a little taste of the big quiz off. That is our next goal, which I think is at the, if we make $12.50 a month, we'll do a big quiz off between all the different podcasters, which should be a lot of fun. Also, if you use Amazon, jayandjack.com/Amazon, use the link. Anything you buy in there, a small percentage of the sales goes to the Jay and Jack production fold. Want to again thank AJ Mass for guest hosting this week in place of Jack, who is with my mom on her birthday day. Happy birthday, Mom. And hope you had a great day. But AJ, this is your time to plug away. Where can people find you? I know they've enjoyed your fantastic commentary this week, but where can they find more?
Well, thank you a lot, Jay and Mike, for allowing me to join and share and talk about a show that I really, really love. If you want to find me on Twitter and discuss anything that I said here or anything like that, it's very simple. It's at AJ Mass. Also, you can check out my writing on ESPN.com/fantasy, especially if you're in fantasy baseball leagues. I give advice on points leagues and stuff like that every week. You can listen to Mike and I on the Hamster Factor. You can find us on iTunes and at Podbean. And hey, if you're a fan of baseball, yes, it's Sutton here, available on Amazon.com. It's a good read.
Awesome. Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's not many people know this about me, AJ, but I was actually a mascot handler in the greater Raleigh area. So I was a handler for a couple different of the local sports mascots. So I appreciate the mascot arts very much.
It's a quite a job that a lot of people forget there's an actual Mr. in the Mr. Met suit. So I have much respect for anyone who helps that process along smoothly. So thank you for your service.
Yes, both helped Wooly Bull of the Durham Bulls and Muddy the Mudcats from the Carolina Mudcats. So
awesome.
Fun times. Anywho, again, thank you, AJ. Mike, you do 8 bajillion podcasts, including this one, and another one on the Jane Jack Network, The Fargo, with Jeremiah and Mike. But where can people find all of your fantastic, lovely goodness?
You can find me on Twitter at @AMikeBloomType. That's where I schlep out messaging for all of my podcasts. But yeah, I'm happy to have AJ on to talk about our movie podcast, which is always going. At this point, we are going to be covering Strictly Ballroom, which the concept of the Hamster Factor, just in brief, is that AJ shows me a movie that he has seen before, but I have not. We have talked about everything from Looper to Donnie Darko to the Blair Witch Project. So check that out. We're more than 30 episodes deep at that point. But Fargo is going strong with Jeremiah Panhorst. We just finished the second episode. No Carrie Coon this past episode of Leftover, so I'll have to get my fair share of her this week on Fargo.
Awesome. All right. Well, that is it for this week's Leftovers. We'll see you guys next week for our live show. Next week, Mike is traveling down to Raleigh, North Carolina for our podcast weekend, meetup weekend. A lot of fun things planned for the weekend and closing it out with a live Leftovers with Jay, Jack, and Mike. It'll be on YouTube Live. We'll send out links on our Twitters and all that fun stuff as we get closer to the day. That should be a lot of fun. So we'll do a viewing party for the fourth episode of The Leftovers, and we'll be doing a live podcast right after, which should be a lot of fun. The last time we did a live podcast, Mike, you had a fantastic hat. Do you have any costuming that you're going to bring to this next live show?
Could I bring the same hat and claim it's a Crocodile Dundee hat? Would that fit with the theming?
Or
is that just
work.
Lazy? I think I'm projecting my own laziness and saying that out loud.
It works. It'll work. That should be a lot of fun. Very excited for that next weekend. But if you cannot experience live, don't worry. The show will be posted on all of our feeds. All right. Well, that will do it for this week. We'll see you guys next time. Hasta luego and goodbye.
Bye-bye.